Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Welcome to another classic replay from the archives of Unbelievable. Today, we go back to February 2015, where New Testament scholar, author and speaker Paula Gooder joined Justin Brierley to tackle a range of questions submitted by the listeners. The Old Covenant, eyewitness testimony, how the Gospels were written, and much more is covered in today's replay.
Well, Paula Gooder is a leading New Testament scholar. She's canon theologian at Birmingham Cathedral, resident theologian for the Bible Society, and a much sought-after speaker and author. In fact, I got to know her a bit at last year's Spring Harvest Conference when she and I were both speaking in the same week. Well, we're both there again this year, though I'm speaking in week three and Paula's in week one at the Minehead site. But she's going to be there leading the Bible teaching again at Minehead week one of Spring Harvest. You want to find out more about Spring Harvest and the deals on offer? If you haven't yet got your thoughts together for what you're going to be doing over the Easter period, then do go to springharvest.org. But in advance of today's programme, because we had Paula here, I thought, well, why don't we just pick Paula's brains on a whole range of issues to do with the New Testament? And so I asked you to send in your thoughts via Twitter, Facebook and email, your questions for Paula. And we received lots, many more, unfortunately, that I'm sure we'll get time to address in the course of today's programme. But we're going to put lots of your questions to Paula on the programme today. Well, it's a real pleasure to have you on the programme with me today, Paula. And we're going to be doing, as I've said, something much more sort of a little bit different, at least to usual. We've got a whole load of questions that I've had come in by Facebook, Twitter and email. All kinds of things that I'm going to be throwing at you this afternoon for you to have a go at answering. But before that, let's get a bit of a background to yourself. Mm-hmm. You are obviously a theologian. You're a Bible scholar. Did that light up for you early on in terms of your interest in it, pursuing it academically?
Well, I did theology at Oxford and my tutor was Tom Wright, N.T. Wright. And in terms of academic study, that was the moment where my fires were lit. I mean, it's almost impossible to be in a room with Tom Wright and not get excited about the New Testament. And I had wonderful 3 years being tutored by him, which was amazing.
This will sound very patronising, but I referred to you the other day as the female Tom Wright. I mean, or I said maybe I should call Tom the male Paula Gooder. But evidently his way of looking at scripture has had a big influence on you.
Enormous.
Give us a sense of what it is about the way he has approached the New Testament that has kind of rubbed off on you.
Well, I must just say, before I do that, one of the things I often find really disappointing is I have these great ideas and I'm completely convinced I came up with them all by myself. And then I read Tom's next book and go, that's another one. I think where I was absolutely inspired by how he reads is actually really just down to a fundamental issue, is that often in New Testament studies, what people do are the pre-questions. So they say, well, when was it written? Who wrote it? Where was it written? What, you know, let's do a little bit about how it was put together. And actually, once they've done all of that, they go, oh, that's done now. Lovely.
Yeah.
But what Tom does is he goes in and says, and now what does it mean? What difference does it make? And the bit that really kind of grips me about how he does theology is he really cares what he means and what difference it makes to us. And that for me is the whole difference between dry and dull New Testament scholarship and really exciting stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the things I know that Tom Wright has really done, I think, is awaken a new sense of the you know, the kind of afterlife and the kingdom come that was in Jesus's mind and Paul's mind, whereas we've kind of supplanted it with a slightly ethereal heaven is another place,
yes.
a spiritual realm. And he's brought us back to, now we're talking about a renewed earth, something quite physical,
yes.
interestingly. Mm. And this is an area you've kind of been interested in as well, in terms of looking at heaven and what heaven is and that kind of thing.
Absolutely.
As well.
Absolutely, yes, that's right.
Mm. What's your perspective on this? What do you think we've lost somehow in the Western Church about the reality of the kingdom that is actually painted in the New Testament?
Well, I think what we've done, and you can see how we got there, because it's influenced by later Christian tradition, which was kind of overlaid by all sorts of different forms of Greek philosophy. But what we've done is we've done a kind of a classic split that says things about God are spiritual, things about earth are physical.
Mm.
God is good, therefore earth is bad.
Mm.
And physical things are bad. And it has had an enormous impact on all sorts of ways in which we think about the world, about ourselves, about our bodies. And one of the things, I wrote a book on heaven.
Mm.
And one of the things I was trying to argue in that is that actually within the biblical texts, heaven is a place, just like earth is a place. And heaven is designed to be created right next to earth. So heaven is a place like earth is, only also not like earth is, because it's where God's rule of justice and peace is perfect, whereas what we are trying to do is bring about God's rule of justice and peace on earth. So it's kind of, we've made the wrong distinction between spiritual and physical, whereas the right distinction is between the place where God absolutely reigns and the place where he doesn't reign enough yet.
I'll make sure there's a link from today's website, from the show, to your page where people can find out more if they want to pursue some of these issues. PremierChristianRadio.com/unbelievable for the links to Paula today. But as we're going to give time to answer a whole range of different questions. We'll throw them all at you today, Paula. But before we get to that, when we were setting this up, this show, and to think about the format and everything, one thing that you were quite keen on was the way we do this kind of, you know, looking into theological issues. You weren't so keen on a kind of combative my view versus your view, and let's have, you know, a big old, you know, clashing debate on it. Because that's, you say, you found that not to be the best way of really generating fruit in the end.
No, absolutely. And it's one of my great passions, actually. A friend of mine calls theology a contact sport, which I think is an absolutely great description of it. And so often what we end up doing is kind of doing theology like we do rugby, really.
Yes.
Is that I'll take you out.
Yeah.
And once I've taken you out, I've demonstrated that none of your ideas in any context are any good whatsoever. Whereas actually, the thing about theology is we're talking about God.
Mm.
And God is beyond any of our, you know, get the cleverest person you know in the room, and it's beyond that person to understand God. And actually what we ought to be doing is, rather than saying I'm right and you're wrong, is saying, well, actually, let's put all of our brains together with everything that we've got and see what truth we can learn out of that. And for me, one of my great passions is actually studying theology as dialogue, as conversation.
Sure.
Because the other thing, and maybe it just reveals my inadequacies, is that there are some things about which I am absolutely clear and sure and certain, like the virgin birth, the resurrection. Those things are absolute pillars of my life.
Sure.
There's a whole load of other things where I go, I'm not entirely sure yet. There's this, and then there's that. And actually, what is really important to me is the journey, not the answer.
Yeah, yeah. So you're not necessarily, don't have to have every single I dotted and T crossed. You're happy with a certain amount of, I'm still learning.
Absolutely.
And
a God that I could understand absolutely clearly without any trouble whatsoever wouldn't really be a God that I would want to believe in.
Well, look, let's go to some questions. And if you, by the way, you've missed your chance to ask a question, you can at least send in your thoughts on what Paula has to say today. You can email me, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. You can also, of course, find us online, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Leave a comment under today's programme there. Or indeed, Facebook and Twitter, @unbelievablejb, facebook.com/unbelievablejb to leave some thoughts for me there. But a lot of people got in touch ahead of today's show with their questions. We won't have time for all of them, of course, but we've had a really good, interesting variety of stuff. And quite a few people actually interested in asking, particularly, you know, as a scholar of the New Testament, how much the Jewish law and rituals were sort of changed, what happened in terms of the new, if you like, dispensation or whatever you call it, that Christ brought in that sense. I'll give you a long one and then a short one.
Okay.
This was, first of all, Ben in Tennessee, who said, so go back to Genesis 12 and 22, and there's the covenant there that God makes with Abraham. Genesis 17 mentions specific things about the covenant that are everlasting. For instance, the covenant itself, the land being an everlasting possession, and the sign of the covenant, a.k.a. circumcision. But Paul and the apostles come along in the New Testament, Acts 15, other places, and say that circumcision is no longer necessary. Now, this seems like a hard thing for Christians to reconcile. I don't know if we can say, as some do, that they're just signposts, shadows pointing to the reality found in Christ, because the Bible seems to say earlier on that they are everlasting. And Ben asks, I wonder if Dr. Gooder has any light to shed on the matter. I must confess I sympathise with first century Jews. If a rabbi came along and said that circumcision is no longer necessary when the Torah says it's an everlasting part of the covenant, and that if you don't get circumcised, you'll be cut off from God's people, I don't suppose I would have listened to Paul either, says Ben. So maybe start with Ben, and then we'll go to some more of the questions around this.
Great. Well, I absolutely agree with him. Actually, one of the really important things to do is to recognise actually what's going on in the New Testament. Over and over again, Paul says, is there anything wrong with the law? No. Should the law be abolished? No. What am I trying to say? I'm not saying that there's anything kind of fundamentally wrong with Judaism. I paraphrase, you understand.
Sure.
And actually what we need to understand is there's a double dynamic going on in Paul's writings, which, unless you understand it, it does become really confusing, which is that there is one thing that Paul is saying to Jews, and there is another thing that Paul is saying to Gentiles.
Okay.
So what is really important is, if you are Jewish, of course you must be circumcised and of course you must follow the law. Mm-hmm. It doesn't make you better than Gentiles who don't.
Okay.
And if we kind of take a step back and kind of understand the first century context, the context in which all of this discussion emerges is in the context of, what do Gentiles have to do in order to become a follower of Christ? That's the question of Paul.
That was the big thing in their day,
wasn't it? Yeah, their big question.
Yeah.
Not, what do Jews have to do? Mm-hmm. Because Jesus was Jewish. You know, it's quite obvious what Jews have to do. Yeah. They carry on being Jewish and worship Christ. That's straightforward. But entirely obviously, and for reasons that we can all see, the assumption of the Jerusalem church, led by people like James and then also by people like Peter, was that if you wanted to follow Christ, you must become Jewish first and then follow Christ.
Yeah.
And Paul's point was, no, you don't. Mm. The whole point is that in Christ, the full covenant is available for you. There is a new way of engaging now, new way, a new constitution of the people of God. So if you were a member of the people of God already, there's one set of rules. And if you weren't a member of the people of God already, then there are different expectations of you. So I'd say to Ben, actually, nothing's changed.
Okay. And in that sense, is that covenant made with the specific Jewish people still a covenant that stands, as far as you can see, from the Old Testament?
I would say that that's what Romans 9 to 11 is all about.
Yeah.
Is that, you know, there will come a time when the established covenant of the people of God will be gathered in to the rest of the newly constituted people of God. They don't have to stop being Jewish any more than we have to start being Jewish. The recognition is that we are all one in Christ Jesus, you know, familiar phrase from Paul. But that doesn't mean that you stop being Jewish or stop being Gentile in order to be gathered and be one in Christ Jesus.
Another question that turns around this issue of the level of observance that the new Christians had to have. Helen asks, my question is, with the birth of the early church, what level of Torah observance, if any, did the Jewish disciples of Jesus maintain? I wonder if you've got any thoughts on that one.
Vast amounts.
How much time have we got?
Yeah, that's right. In that, again, they were being faithful Jews and faithful Jews who worshipped Christ. And the two were really important. And so therefore, you know, and you will encounter through the New Testament in Acts and in various bits of 1 Corinthians, questions about the niceties of it. You know, should you eat food offered to idols? Is a kind of nicety of a question of what do you do in a Jewish and a Gentile context in which this kind of thing goes on. And so therefore, I would say that actually it is highly likely that most of the first century Jews did in fact practice the vast majority of Torah commands on them. The bit where Paul, where it all becomes a lot more challenging, and I think it's the bit that the consequences of what Paul said kind of were lived out and people began to realise how complicated it was, is that, is purity. He said, in order within the Judaism of the first century to remain pure, one of the key things that you didn't do was eat with Gentiles.
Okay.
If therefore, you know, and if you remember Acts 15, that's kind of one of the crucial kind of nubs of the argument in Acts 15. And so then the question is, should first century Jews put their purity in danger because of what it was that they, because they were eating with Gentiles? And that's where it became a lot more complicated. But apart from that, I would say most first century Jews would have gone to synagogue on a Saturday and then to table fellowship with fellow Christians on a Sunday.
Would the destruction of the temple have made a significant difference in the way the early Christians would have, in AD 70, have expressed, if they were of Jewish background, their devotion?
I think that would have been one of the crucial moments where everything begins to change. One of the things we can notice from first century Judaism until 70 is that actually there seems to be quite a wide variety of different ways of being Jewish. You know, you could be a Jew of an Essene variety, or a Jew of a Pharisaic variety, Jew of a Sadducean variety. You had some slightly bonkers wandering prophets like Banus in the desert. But they were all somehow held together by the temple worship. Once the temple went, then actually what you end up with much later on is one dominant form of Judaism, which was rabbinic Judaism, which probably grew out of Pharisaic Judaism. And it's at that point when it became almost impossible to be a different kind of Jew, for obvious and really good reasons. But that's how it got to that stage. It of course raises questions about the persecution of no doubt listeners are going, but what about the persecution of Christians in the first century? That is an issue which is kind of interesting
and related. Speaking of AD 70, one of the questions that's come in, sort of similar question, two different people. Derek asks, what date would Paula give for the earliest gospel? I assume this will be taken to be Mark. And how much consensus or disagreement is there in academia on that? And in a similar manner, Dustin Savage on Twitter asked the question, is the position that the New Testament was written before 70 AD defensible at all? Or something along those lines, he says. So it's questions around how early were the Gospels put down, and you know, does AD 70 feel like a date before which we can at least assume Mark was being written? What about the rest of the New Testament? How early was that? Any thoughts on that?
Oh, loads. It's, again, a really complex area. But one of the really interesting things, I think, about kind of the development of the Gospels is that by the time we got to the end of the 20th century, kind of start of the 21st century, there was a rough consensus, and it's very rough, and there are people who disagreed, which basically said that the Gospels emerged, some people would say as early as 67, but not much earlier than 67, some people kind of more in 72, that kind of area, and that Mark was written first. Following on from Mark, you've got Matthew and Luke being written. Some people think there was this putative source known as Q, and that Q what lies behind Mark, and then Matthew had Mark and Q, and Luke had Mark and Q, and there's a lot of discussions about precisely how it emerged, and that was a rough consensus for quite a long time, and the assumption was that there were the events of Jesus's life, then people talked about the events of Jesus's life, and slowly over time they became something known as oral sources. They were kind of passed along in oral sources, and then as over time, as time went on, these began to be written down, and if people want to identify Q, then they would identify Q as the earliest written source, and then you have the gospel writers, who effectively then become much more gospel editors, in that they have written sources and they begin to shape them. That's
together.
The kind of consensus.
Okay. Mm.
But then Richard Baucom wrote a book called Jesus and the Gospels and the Eyewitnesses.
Yes, I had him on this show to talk about it.
Which I think is a spectacular book. Mm. And not least, it blows some of that consensus out of the water.
Okay.
Now, it's not all that old in terms of New Testament scholarship, and actually how it's all going to settle down is really not clear. But what's fascinating about his book is his argument that eyewitness accounts probably do lie behind the gospel texts, and possibly even actual eyewitness accounts.
Right.
So that Mark is written out of an actual eyewitness account, and maybe Matthew and maybe Luke as well, which kind of blows all of that consensus out of the water.
It's interesting. I mean, but in terms of whether it was eyewitness or whatever, the actual writing down. Are you a kind of an early Mark kind of person, in as much as, you know, some people go as early as 40 or 50 AD, others say no, it would have been in the latter part of the first century.
I have a problem with the question, which is a really interesting one, is we assume we're kind of functioning on modern understandings of a book. Mm. You know, so when did I write my book Heaven?
You turn
to the copyright page and you see what date I wrote my book Heaven on, and you attribute it to that year.
Yes.
Whereas I know that I didn't write that book in 2011. It was being written in my head and on my computer and in various different forms for probably about 6 or 7 years before that.
Mm.
Extrapolate that out to the Gospels. Mm. And I think asking when was it written is probably the wrong question.
Okay.
What we're probably asking was, at what point did people stop writing it?
Yes.
Did they step away and let it alone and say, we're not doing any more on that? And that may well be kind of the 70 date.
Sure.
But I think it's highly unlikely that there weren't snippets and odd bits and maybe even a gospel that would look a little bit like the gospel we've got from Mark that comes from quite early. This is a really important story. You're not going to risk it dying out.
Yeah.
So when do I think it started to be written and when do I think it finished being written are two entirely different questions.
Yeah.
And I would give it 30, 40 years. And incidentally, John's gospel, I think, is a really interesting example of a gospel that's written over time. And you can see it written over time.
Yeah, sure. I mean, two other questions that came in sort of, I think, would be appropriate at this point, talking about how the gospels were written down and that kind of thing. Because Tom Tozer also asked this issue of eyewitness testimony, says, what is the consensus view of the gospels as containing eyewitness testimony? Mm. Now, you've already said Richard Baucom has sort of put his hat into the ring. But what's your view? Is there a consensus about eyewitness testimony at this point?
Not
really,
Or is this kind of a new area? No, it's a new area. And some people have seized up his ideas with great enthusiasm and other people have rejected them out of hand.
Right.
So
there's no consensus.
There's no consensus at all,
on this, but it's worth looking at. In a related question, Paula, both Simon Turner and Steve Pond both ask similar sorts of questions, so I'll give them both. Simon asks, does Paula think that the words of Jesus recorded in the Bible are perfectly accurate, or are they paraphrases? Mm. And if they're not the exact words, why do we spend so much time and emphasis on the precise word used? And Steve asks a similar sort of question. He says, is it fair to say that an incident like the Sermon on the Mount never happened, but rather a literary device to present the teachings of Jesus that he most likely gave in many different locations? Do you think in the Gospels there are other events used in the same way to represent a teaching he gave on other occasions across the country? Many thanks. So this is questions about, you know, when the Gospels were written down and the teachings of Jesus were included, can we say that, yes, these were definitely the words he used? Are they paraphrases? Have they kind of been all put together at certain points, like the Sermon on the Mount, to kind of give an overall flavour of the teachings he gave, though he may not have said all of those things in one place on a mountainside? What's going on here, Paula?
Well, the paraphrase question, the obvious answer to that is, of course, they're not his original words because he wasn't speaking Greek.
Right, sure. By definition,
they are not his accurate words because we assume and there is nothing to suggest otherwise that Jesus spoke Aramaic Jews of the first century did. And so therefore someone has attempted.
And by the time they're turned into English, we're even further away from the original Aramaic.
And when people say, what do you think about the original text? Well, the kind of the sad truth of the Gospels is we haven't got the original text.
Yeah.
And we don't even know if it was written down in Aramaic first. There are some people who've tried to back translate Mark into Aramaic. Not wildly convincingly, in my view.
Mm.
So actually, no, we don't have Jesus's absolute words. But what I would say, well, let me just say something about inspiration at that point, because I think it's quite an important one. Often we have a kind of very narrow view of inspiration that says, well, Jesus was inspired because he was the Son of God.
Mm.
And if Mark, for example, were absolutely accurately copying down what Jesus said, then he would be copying down the inspired words of God.
Okay.
Otherwise, it's not inspired.
Okay.
And I want to go, that's far too narrow an understanding of inspiration. This is what I believe, what many of us believe, to be God's living, breathing word speaking to us. You don't really think that God would just be hanging around in 67 or 72 at one point. You're going, inspired now, now not inspired. This is a long inspired text.
Okay.
So therefore, I would say God was involved in the remembering of the stories, in the translating them of into Greek, into the writing them down, into scribes copying them. And dare I even say, maybe, in our English translations. It doesn't mean that every single word in an English translation is true, but equally, you know, true as in couldn't have been better, couldn't have been improved on. But equally, surely God would be involved in the inspiration of all of it. So I think, are they accurate words of Jesus? No, because he wasn't speaking, because he was speaking Aramaic. But actually, was God involved in the communication of what we hear? Absolutely.
Yeah.
And therefore, poring over the Greek word is therefore really important.
Okay. And in that sense, then, yes, inevitably, it's a paraphrase of Jesus because it's a different language it was written down in from what he was speaking. Mm. I mean, when it comes to the way it's presented, though, as Steve asks, you know, you get something like the Sermon on the Mount with a kind of whole bunch of teaching all in a row. Mm. You know, are we to assume that did happen? You know, Jesus was there teaching to a crowd, or the disciples, I think, actually, and giving all of that information in one go, and it was therefore all written down by Matthew? Or can we assume that Matthew was kind of maybe taking a lot of different stuff he said and saying, I'm going to put this all into one sermon, as it were, because I can't remember exactly everything he said on every single occasion.
Well, so many things to say on that subject, which it's a fascinating one. I think the first thing I would want to say is, I don't think it was a sermon, because it has to be the worst sermon in history.
You know, where's your 3 points?
But it's got no structure, it's got no stories.
Yeah.
And the one thing we know about Jesus is he is a stonkingly good communicator.
Mm.
And have you ever sat and tried to listen to the whole of the Sermon on the Mount? It doesn't flow.
No.
It's kind of, it goes all over the place. It has no structure, no narrative, no nothing that we know about what Jesus did in terms of teaching.
Sure.
It's the first thing I'd like to say. The second thing I'd like to say is that if we go with John's gospel, then we assume that Jesus's ministry was 3 years long.
Mm-hmm.
John's the one who suggests it to us, but we haven't got another suggestion, so let's go with 3 years long. Just imagine how much teaching Jesus did in 3 years.
Mm.
And you realise that actually what we've got in front of us are the tiniest snippets of his teaching. And I think it's highly likely that Jesus said things more than once.
Mm-hmm.
If it's really important, he's going to say it 5, 6, 7, 10 times.
As any good preacher
times.
Does.
Absolutely.
Every preacher's probably preached their best sermon 20
times.
Yeah,
that's right, precisely. So if he wants different groups to hear it, he will have said it.
Mm.
And so therefore, for me, the Sermon on the Mount is here's all the really important stuff. We mustn't lose all the important stuff. Let's make sure we put that together. But I don't think that that's how Jesus communicated, because there are two things that are a marker for me about Jesus's communication. One of them is stories.
Mm.
And normally what you discover is this teaching comes at the end of a story. Often in Mark's gospel, you see it, where he'll tell a parable and then you'll have a big piece of teaching, even if it's only 3 verses long, at the end of it. And the second thing is that he asks questions. Jesus's primary teaching manner is asking questions. And the odd thing about the Sermon on the Mount is there's not a question to be found, almost not a question to be found. And therefore, I think actually what it's doing is saying, let's gather all together the really important stuff so we don't lose it. But then you discover how Jesus taught in other places, which I would say is through stories and with questions.
Great stuff. Thank you very much, Paul. We're going to take a quick break and we'll be back with more questions. We've only got a smattering them through a smattering them so far. I'll have to do a few more rapid fire ones in the next round.
Yes or no answers.
Paula Gooder, my guest today on Unbelievable. She's going to be at Minehead for Spring Harvest in April. And you can find out more about that from links from today's programme as well. So we'll be continuing to grill Paula with a few more questions that you've sent in over the last week or two here on the show that aims to get you thinking. This Saturday afternoon, Unbelievable.
This podcast is an outreach of Premier Insight and it's made possible through the support of listeners like you. And your support today is so vital. We want to thank you for your generous gift by giving you exclusive access to Science, Faith and the Evidence for God apologetics course. This 9-module course invites you to learn from John Lennox, one of the most celebrated Christian thinkers of our time, through conversations with atheist thinker Michael Ruse and secular talk show host Dave Rubin. You'll be empowered to confidently speak into conversations on faith, science, and why believing in God is not only reasonable, but logical. The course is free to you to thank you for your gift to help Premier Insight equip more Christians to confidently speak into the biggest issues of our culture and defend their Christian faith with conviction and grace. To get access to Science, Faith, and the Evidence for God, simply go to premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. That's premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. Unbelievable show. Thank you for your support.
Okay, let's throw another question at you then, Paula. How about this one? We've been talking about it in the last section, how Jesus's words were written down. But what about the way they depict his life? Brian asks this question. Do you believe the Gospels depict an accurate account of Jesus's life? But if so, why do they conflict so much, especially in the simple crucifixion narrative? What day? What time? Earthquake? Final words? Etc. Okay, so do you want to lay out maybe what the problem is? And then what, if you think there is a resolution?
The crucifixion is a fascinating text, really, kind of account of Jesus' life, because, as Brian so rightly says in his question, it is almost impossible to squish them together in such a way as that they make sense as a single narrative. So, for example, in John's Gospel, Jesus is crucified the day earlier than he is apparently in the Synoptic Gospels. Mm. In Matthew's Gospel, there is an earthquake as Jesus dies, which is not reported in any one of the other Gospels. Those are the two examples. Mm. There's all sorts of other details that are different as well. The wording that's used at various different points differs. You just can't kind of run them together. And it raises for us the really interesting question of how do you get to the historical basis of what's going on? And I think the first thing I'd like to do is kind of to push back a little bit and say it is remarkable how much there is in common, even though there are some details that are different. Mm. You do have in all of the accounts that Jesus was crucified by the Romans, that he had thieves on either side of him, yeah, or robbers, or whatever, yeah, word you want to use at that particular point. You have the fact that he was offered wine either once or twice while he was on the cross. You have the tearing of the temple veil in the Synoptic Gospels. You have kind of key bits that are in all of them. And so the first thing I'd want to say is that you have a base tradition that agrees, even though there are details that, that are different. And for me, that's one of the really important things to recognise, is that it's true also, incidentally, of the birth narratives, where people throw up their hands in horror and say, look at all these differences. Yeah. Actually, there's a lot of similarities. Yeah. Okay. He was born in Bethlehem. Yeah. His parents were called Mary and Joseph. Yeah. He had visitors.
All that kind
of stuff, which is a base tradition. Mm. So the difference is not the base tradition, it's the details.
Yeah.
And that's when you get into interesting questions about the nature of historicity. Mm. And I think I would want to say is, say today there was a car crash and you pulled 5 witnesses off the street on the very same day and you said to them, tell us what colour the car was that passed before the crash happened. Tell us who was on the other side of the street. Tell us exactly what time it was. And tell us, whose fault the crash was.
Yeah.
police generally say that you'll get five different answers.
Sure,
the
sure.
details are always different, in even in eyewitnesses' account, witness accounts. And I think that gives you a clue into why we've got the differences in Jesus's crucifixion. The base stuff is the same, the important stuff is the same, but it's the details that are different.
Yeah, I suppose, you know, a lot of people at that point then say, but don't Christians claim that this is the perfect word of God and therefore there should be no inconsistencies whatsoever between these different accounts? Well, I mean, what do you say to that kind of a view of whether this should be, in that sense, quote unquote, inerrant, and therefore all the details should perfectly line up?
Well, I probably should reveal that I believe in infallibility rather than inerrancy. In the more popular understanding of infallibility, which is that it is to be relied on, it is the Bible is absolutely trustworthy, but not that it is absolutely accurate in every detail, for precisely the reasons that we've just brought up, which is that it's almost impossible to decide what day of the week Jesus was crucified on from the text. And I don't think, personally, I can't support inerrancy for that reason.
Right.
But I do want to say that it's infallible,
that
actually the Bible is absolutely trustworthy for everything that I need to know about salvation. And that tells you what is really important about what the Bible does, is that it reveals to us the living, breathing Word of God that helps us to understand who God is, that understands the nature of Christ, and also gives us everything that we need to understand for the nature of salvation.
Which leads nicely into Andrew's question, where he says, should we think twice about saying the Bible is the first and last word in all matters of history, science and ethics? And he also follows that up with, and should its authority and influence be limited to spiritual matters? So are we supposed to read the Bible, if you like, as a sort of having an authority in all matters, historical, scientific, ethical and so on? Or should we kind of, you know, hive off spiritual matters as what we take the Bible as authoritative about?
Let me answer the second one first and then got on to the first bit. Absolutely not.
Okay.
Because I don't think the Bible is solely about spiritual matters. And back to part of a conversation we've had earlier today, is that actually that is our fundamental problem as Christians, where we've said the spiritual stuff that God is involved in, and then there's the rest of the stuff that God is not involved in. God is the creator of the whole universe. And therefore, there is nothing that God is not involved in. The whole point about the Bible, and one of the reasons we find the Bible difficult from time to time, is because it is a story which is a political story. It's a historical story. It kind of dabbles in all sorts of stuff. There is no such thing as just a spiritual bit of the Bible. It's about the physical world, so it can't be just spiritual. And so therefore I would say it's not just a spiritual book. Should it have authority? That's a really interesting question. It depends what you mean by it. If you mean that the Bible is so absolutely and utterly right on our interpretation about what it means that anyone who comes along and says something different is absolutely wrong, well, I think that's where we've hit problems in the past in people's engagement with the Bible. You know, the classic one being the creation narrative in Genesis 1. We say the world is created like this. Scientists say we don't agree. So Christians say, well, you're wrong then. I think what a lot of modern Christians would say is that actually the Bible does have something very powerful to say, but we need to recognise it's not a 21st century scientific textbook, nor is it a 21st century political textbook or any of the other kind of textbooks. It has an authority in that it speaks with authority into a situation. That doesn't mean that you have, therefore, to read everything off what we're saying.
Sure.
I can't quite get my words out, but you see what I mean?
What you
mean. It's allowing the Bible to be what it is and not forcing it to be what it's not.
Okay.
And what it is the, I've used my phrase a number of times, I'll use it again, the living, breathing Word of God.
It's inspired. That
reveals,
it's inspired
and it reveals things of God to us as we read it.
But not necessarily the exact scientific way in which the world was created so on. I mean, you'll have to explain this one to me, because another one came in and I'm not even sure I know what the question means. But this was by Twitter, Reddish CF. How important is it to study the Sitz im Leben of a text rather than just the text itself? So if you could first of all translate Sitz im Leben.
Sitz im Leben is a German phrase,
yes.
Which means setting in life.
Okay.
So basically, that kind of goes back to one of the principles of the historical critical method in New Testament and Old Testament studies, which is the argument by a lot of scholars that actually what you need to do is understand what the text meant originally,
sure.
In order to be able to understand what it means.
Okay.
And then you kind of set up a really interesting conversation, and this is where I'm into the interesting conversation, is that there are some historical critical scholars who would say the only thing that a text can mean is what the author originally intended it to mean when they first wrote it. So the only thing that Romans can mean, for example, is what Paul meant Romans to mean when he wrote it in the first century. But in contrast to that is the very popular and still rightly practiced way of reading the Bible, where you open it and see what God says to you,
right.
Which has nothing to do with its original context. It's actually God speaking directly into my life. And often they're set up as kind of opposite poles. And the problem, of course, is that actually what a Bible text means for us today can get us into some difficulties if we don't understand something about the historical context. And quite frankly, there are some biblical texts where you look at it and go, I have no idea. No, it's not speaking into my life because I haven't the foggiest what it's talking about.
Because I don't know who Zerubbabel was and why he's relevant to my life today.
Precisely, that's right. You know, and so actually neither of those methods is good on their own.
Sure.
And so what I am interested in is actually bringing those two into conversation with each other. Of course the Spirit speaks to us when we read the Bible, but maybe the Spirit might speak even more clearly and more vibrantly if we understood a little bit more about the historical context that made Paul say what it is that he said in Romans.
I mean, I sometimes hear it said, for instance, some people get a bit sniffy about some Christians, you know, have, you know, favourite verses, life verses, let's say. The one from Jeremiah about, I know the plans I have for you, plans for a future and hope and so on. Mm. And they say, well, that was written to, you know, Jews in the diaspora, in the, the exile or
the
whatever.
Exile. Yeah, that's right, yes.
To their situation. What are you doing sort of saying, oh, that was written for me and isn't it lovely? What's your kind of view on that? Can we kind of take stuff that's evidently has a historical setting in which it was written and say, no, that's for me, actually. I mean, is this the kind of the thing of it? It speaks to them and it speaks to us by the Spirit today.
Well,
is that what's
going
on?
For me, one of the really important things to recognise about the biblical understanding of history is that for us, history is a straight line. You know, it started at creation, it'll end at the end of all times, and we're kind of moving along the straight line from one end to the other, never to return. Whereas what you get from the Bible is an understanding of history which is much more circular, but it goes forward, but it's much more like a spiral than it is like a kind of a straight line. And kind of that recognition that God acts again and again and again. And the reason why the New Testament writers read the Old Testament stories and why they bring them into their narratives so often is because they believed that the God who was the God of the Exodus is still the same God. So if God is going to free his people once, he's going to do it again. The God of wilderness wanderings is the same God. So if you want to know who God is, you look at what he did. And so therefore, that's the both-and-ness. You need to know that Jeremiah was written to a people in exile because it helps you understand why that was an important thing to say to them at that point. And then we say, and that God hasn't changed. We believe that that God who knew the plans for the people of the exile is still the same God who knows the plans that he has for us. So yes, it was true for them, and yes, it was true for us, and incidentally, was true for thousands of people in between them and us as well. So recognising the circular element of it, not just kind of the straight line bit.
Brilliant stuff. Let's take a quick break just to mention, if you're listening and you'd like to respond to anything that Paul has had to say today, you're more than welcome to drop me a line, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Be fascinated to hear what you think about some of the issues we've covered. And we've covered off a lot already. You're doing brilliantly, Paula, with all these, these questions we're throwing at you. I've got a few more before our time's up that we'll try and fit in. If you want to listen back to today's show, pass it on to someone else. Don't forget the website is premierchristianradio.com/ Unbelievable. You can look at today's show. You can comment on it underneath. You can find more resources from Paula. And don't forget, Paula's one of the Bible teachers at this year's Spring Harvest. I'm going to be there myself, but not in the same week, unfortunately, as Paula. But if you are around for Minehead Week three, I think it is, I'll be leading some seminars on the big questions, some apologetic stuff. But that's across all of the weeks. Other people leading some of the other ones as well. So do look out for that. All the details at the Spring Harvest website. If you haven't got your plans yet together for Easter, not too late to book yourself into one of the weeks, both in Skegness and Minehead. Okay, let's take some more questions here on today's show. We're asking the questions of Dr. Paula Gooder, who's a Bible teacher and theologian.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Okay, Paula, let's ask at least maybe one or two more before we have to draw things to a close. I've got one here. I've always assumed from the text that Paul and the New Testament writers, including apparently Jesus himself, clearly thought that the end of the age was coming soon. I've read various interpretations on this, but I'm not satisfied as to why the end wasn't predicted or expected accurately. The only thing I conclude is that the end was meant to come earlier, but that circumstances have interfered or frustrated the timeline. Of course, that has implications about sovereignty and open theism and all kinds of things, says Kevin in Oregon. OK, this is a kind of a familiar sort of one that I think people do come to when they read in Matthew and other places, Jesus is appearing to talk about, you know, this generation won't pass away before the end has come. And Paul seems to always live in expectation of an imminent second coming of Jesus. So what do we do with this? What 2,000 years later, and apparently Jesus still hasn't returned. Where do you go with these texts, Paula?
I need to warn you in advance, this is complex theology. Okay. So take a deep breath and be ready for this.
Switch on your complex switch in your brain.
And I think part of the problem is that we try and make it too straightforward and too simple.
Okay.
When you realise that it is actually a really complex issue, then in a bizarre way it becomes more easier to understand.
Okay.
So, the Jews believed that God would intervene in their world to change it forever.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the prophecies like Isaiah are all about that moment when God is going to intervene and the world is going to become a completely different place. And if you read your way through the Gospels and you realise that people are kind of following Jesus around going, I don't quite understand, because this was our expectation of how the world was going to change, and it's kind of a little bit different, and it's not quite as we expected it. And you can almost feel the brain cogs kind of whirring as they're not understanding what's going on. And then you need to understand that actually that fulfillment of God intervening happens through the gospel texts in a variety of different ways. So the angels at Jesus' birth sing, glory to God in the highest heaven and on earth peace. If you have anything that Isaiah was looking forward to, it was that God's glory would be revealed and there would be peace on earth. Mm. So the angels say at Jesus' birth, it's happened.
Okay.
And yet it hasn't all happened, has it? Because there's more still to come.
Mm.
So then you fast track onto the resurrection, and you realise that one, some of the confusion of the disciples around the resurrection is that in Jewish belief, the resurrection was the marker of the start of the new age.
Yes.
So Jesus has been raised. Well, where's the new age?
Yes.
And then you realise that actually what the gospel writers and Paul are saying is that actually the new age is breaking in. It's already started, which is why Paul can talk in 2 Corinthians 5 about new creation.
Yeah.
The new age is among us, and it's happened in a new form, in a different form. You fast track it forward a little bit more, and you realise that some of the prophecies that Jesus talks about in places like Mark 13 are fulfilled at 70 when the temple was destroyed by the Romans.
Mm.
And then you begin to realise that actually what we're looking for is one moment on a linear map that says this is the moment when it's going to happen.
Mm.
Whereas actually what God is saying is at the birth of Jesus, the world changed forever.
Okay.
And it continues to change, particularly through the resurrection, particularly when the Spirit comes, and also when the temple is destroyed. So this is a grand narrative of now and not yet.
Mm.
So, of course, they were expecting it to happen because it was imminent. And actually, it was happening.
Mm.
At the same time is the not yetness.
Yes.
And kind of part of the teaching of Jesus in the Gospels and therefore also of Paul is you need to be ready for the absolute full culmination of it. And in order to be ready for that, you need to be able to see the many, many, mini moments when the new age is breaking in. there are big moments of the resurrection and there are kind of mini moments when the new age is kind of functioning.
Yeah.
And as Christians, we are invited to live the new creation, which is the existence that we will have come the resurrection early. I told you it was complicated.
Inevitably, I suppose. But so in that sense, what do we mean by the second coming of Christ? Because do we believe there is still going to be this, you know, to use the fancy term, eschatological event in which everyone will see and, you know, every knee will bow and so on, in which or is that kind of, is it some kind of progressive event that happens over time?
I believe, to pick up your fancy phrase, in an eschatological event, you know, I believe that there will be a grand end moment, you know, the moment when it all comes to its fulfilment. And I passionately believe that because it makes sense of everything else.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I also believe in the fact that we need to be living now as though we are already living that moment.
And when Paul's anticipating, almost it would seem, within his lifetime, this event, did he get that wrong? Or was it that we've just slightly misunderstood his kind of emphasis there?
It's a difficult question. And everything in me rebels to say he was wrong.
Right.
And I think actually he was right to believe that it was imminent, just as we remain right to believe that it's imminent, because it changes how you live.
Yeah.
You know, to use a kind of a sideways example, really, is that if you know that your death is absolutely imminent, you live differently. And I think what Paul is talking about is living as though you know that this event is on the cusp. Was he wrong? I'm not sure that he was, because I think he was right that we should live our lives in that kind of expectation. And I don't think you can manufacture the expectation. You'll see that I'm kind of... It is the imponderable, and I'm grappling on the hook a little bit, and I need to kind of get to the point where I think all of us theologians need to get to.
It may be one of those areas where you're happy to say there's grey and I'm willing to keep looking.
That's right. But I'm unwilling to say that he was wrong, but he was clearly not entirely right at the same time.
It's been fascinating chatting with you, and going from the sublime to the ridiculous, though not ridiculous because it's the everyday. Just the last question I'll leave to Mo Baldwin, who says, how much time do you spend on your housework, and how much time reading theology books, how much time on Facebook? So if you could just give us an exact timeline of what you do.
Well, I do need to say that I know Mo and she knows the answer to that. So she was being facetious. The answer is far too much time on Facebook, far too much time reading theology, and far too little time on housework.
In any case, we've appreciated the time you have spent in theology and the way you've been able to dispense some of that learning for us on the programme today. Paula, it's been a real pleasure having you on the programme today.
Thank you for
coming in.
Thank you for listening to this week's Classic Replay. Do let us know what you thought. You can email us at unbelievable@premier.org.uk or leave a comment on our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/premierunbelievable, or tweet us at unbelievablefe. For more resources for exploring faith, head over to our website, premierunbelievable.com, and if you register there, you'll unlock access to all the content on the website, and we'll send you updates and exclusive content through the Premier Unbelievable newsletter, including bonus videos and ebooks. That's premierunbelievable.com. See you next time for another classic replay of Unbelievable.